Gordon Call was right when he made his famous stand. Heaven knows there was a man who fought the righteous fight till the wrong arm of the law gunned him down in Arkansas. He would not pay one dime of tribute to the IRS, and for his disobedience they planned his fiery death. And now all is fair in love and war. Christian blood has been shed before, and though these tents of flesh may fail, the gates of hell shall never prevail. Because he gave his life for me, I shall not fear adversity, and we shall all meet at heaven's door. 'Cause all is fair in love and war. PM on a North Dakota road, February '83, that's when the war began, where two federal marshals died for the sake of tyranny. They both would underestimate the courage of one man who only shot in self-defense to save his promised land. Fair in love and war, Christian blood has been shed before, and though these tents of flesh may fail, the gates of hell shall never prevail. Because he gave his life for me, I shall not fear adversity, and we shall all meet at heaven's door. 'Cause all is fair in love, in love. When all was said and done, and the verdict's handed down, someone had to take the fall, and it was Gordon's son, who was wounded in the fray. Please won't you pray for your recall, who now must waste his life away inside some stinking jail. Please pray the Lord might set him free, through faith we shall prevail. Shed before, and though these tents of flesh may fail, the gates of hell shall never prevail. Because he gave his life for me, I shall not fear adversity, and we shall all meet at heaven's door. 'Cause all is fair in love.
Yes, old Gordon Call was a fighter, a veteran of World War II, who the feds took on in the cold evening on the roads and the highway there. And they shot it out, and Gordon Call was defending himself, and so was his son, Yorie Call. Then Gordon Call fled to Arkansas, staying in a friend's house. They surrounded the house, kept pumping bullets into the house, couldn't get him out, so they poured gasoline down the chimney and burned him alive, just like Robert Matthews. That's the way they are, these filthy sons of bitches. But at least they got two of the bastards. Unfortunately, Yorie Call, as far as I know, is still in prison. A sad story of a man, Gordon Call, who's a hero, really. And we got a lot of them in the joint like that. Well, it's September the 25th, 2017, Moon's Day. Anyway, don't ever forget Gordon Call if you don't know the story. There's a book around about it. I should have that book here someplace, but it's available. See, these federal boys delight in killing one of ours. They get all giddy about it. They just love it. Like that Lon Hiroshi, the Asian who killed was the killer at Ruby Ridge. Well, they got one of them. They got one of those feds there too. So, if you don't think there's a war still going on, you're unpleasantly mistaken. It's still going on. It's going to be going on for a long time. Well, let's see what kind of trouble we can get into today, boys and girls. Oh yeah, there's something that I didn't know. Or at least, if I did know, I forgot about it. You know, John McCain, that dirty little bastard from Arizona. Turns out he was a good buddy with Ted Kennedy, the most liberal of the liberals, the most progressive of the progressives. So why would a conservative, so-called conservative Republican be the best buddy with a son of a bitch like Ted Kennedy? No wonder he's so screwed up. Well, that guy should have been in federal prison, old John McCain, for his role in the Iran-Contra affair and the Nicaraguan situation. But these guys never go to jail. They'll never be arrested and drug before a court like our friends are. Yeah. The N-word football players are all pissed off. Probably saw it on the news. They get down on one knee in disrespect for the national flag and so forth. I don't get excited about it either. But they're acting like spoilt babies. Spoilt N-word babies. And I put on Twitter, I said, all these blacks should get down on their knees to the white owners of all the football and baseball teams that make fortunes off these guys. And they're too stupid to know what's going on. By the time they get done with a few seasons of heavy-duty football, their body's so screwed up they'll never be the same. But I think it's being played just right. Yeah, I think the president is playing it just right. He's going to fracture them right down the middle. Because his base is going to really turn on this professional football and stuff. However, they're fanatics. A hell of a lot of our people are N-word fanatics. N-word ball. Nigger ball. They're fanatics. That's all they think about. Six-pack of beer and a football game. Life's not that simple. If they had to live off my money, I'll tell you, they'd be in trouble. Because I've never been to a professional football game. I've only been to a couple of three professional baseball games. And so I've been to a couple of hockey games. That's about it for me. Because I see professional sports as one of the worst dangers of the white race. Professional sports has done more to screw up the white race than almost anything else. I don't see how you can claim to be a white separatist and put your money behind these professional football players and stuff. The ones that are dating all these beautiful blonde girls, cheerleaders. Yeah. I've run into guys like that they could go to a Klan rally on one night and then go to nigger ball the next night. Weird. Today we're going to cover one of the bloodiest strikes by mostly white workers in the history of this country, called the steel lockout at Homestead, Pennsylvania. The bloodiest capital labor conflict so far. Throughout our country's history, the white working man has sought to improve his condition. The principal workmen in the colonies were skilled craftsmen and their apprentices, and it was not until after the Revolutionary War and the break in the ties with England that industry expanded and a true working class came into being. The development of manufacturing brought together large numbers of workers under one factory roof and in a single specialized industry. Trade unions were the result of the banding together for the improvement of their common welfare. A union's purpose was and still is to form a means of contact and negotiation between the employers and the employees in a single work situation, and beginning in the latter half of the 19th century in an entire industry. The resulting struggle between capital and labor, or more definitely, between employees and employees, or management and workers, has been long and often violent. During the late 1800s, industrial leaders almost uniformly resented the demands of workers and considered that their defiance represented nothing short of mutiny. The ideal situation from the standpoint of management was to control a docile labor force who would accept unquestionably any terms and conditions of work. The strike, however, has always been the principal means of obtaining worker demands. With or without accompanying demonstrations or picketing, it may erupt into violence and in extreme cases into full-scale riot. The sit-down or sit-down strike, a work stoppage in which employees refuse to leave their place of employment, is comparatively new in labor history. The employer equivalent of the sit-down is the lockout, in which management withholds employment by closing a plant or temporarily stopping its operation as a means of forcing workers to accept its terms. A strike, in the definition of the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics, is a temporary stoppage of work by a group of employees in order to express a grievance or to enforce a demand, unquote. A more emotionally tinged definition by a sympathetic pro-labor writer is, quote, a practical protest or a revolt, frequently successful against the wrongs which may be unendurable, unquote. These grievances and wrongs have traditionally involved unionization, open versus closed shop, wages, hours of work, and working conditions. Strikes increase during eras of business prosperity when wage demands stand a better than ordinary chance of acceptance. During a depression period, strikers are apt to be in desperate economic straits and therefore tend to be to more mob violence. Strike violence appears to follow a definite pattern. The strike begins with peaceful picketing after the leaders have appealed to their forces in favor of obedience to the law and the maintenance of order. Strikers are particularly warned against any resistance to legal authority, for this can inflame a crowd into mob action. A strike of comparative calm is difficult to achieve when the hostility of each side to the other has been building up for a long time. The pre-strike negotiations often intensify this enmity. When obstinacy is met with obstinacy, tempers become frayed, and each side blames the other for the impasse. A self-appointed leader or agitator or a persuasive orator can arouse the strikers, who are already showing their defiance to unthinking and ill-advised actions. Strike leaders are the first to admit that a little violence, a scuffle or altercation between strikers and police or strikers and non-union workers is very often the means of winning a strike, since all rioting springs from the feeling of bitter ill will. Employees are usually pained and worried when strikers have reached this point. Past history offers impressive examples of what might be expected to follow. The result is often a renewal of collective bargaining to the obvious advantage of the workers. As in all riots, a particular incident or situation triggers mob violence. In labor conflicts, as this is most often the hiring of non-union workmen, scabs, in place of strikers. Resentment of the strike breakers, often imported from outside the immediate strike area, stiffens the resistance and obstinacy of the strikers and may incite them to extreme and unrestrained acts, sometimes an unyielding resistance on the part of the employers manifested by a threatening or challenging statement or an ill-timed act will lead to violence and lawlessness. In the 1892 strike of workers at the Carnegie Steel Company in Homestead, Pennsylvania, the violence unparalleled in a labor management dispute before or since followed a long-planned lockout which was to have been enforced by a substantial number of hired and imported private police, goons. The strikers reacted with savage violence against those brought into the community to protect the strike breakers. The Homestead lockout has been appropriately characterized as one of the great battles of workers' rights and a battle which, for bloodthirstiness and boldness, could not be excelled in actual warfare. Homestead, 7 miles east of Pittsburgh on the south bank of the Monongahela River, was typical of many industrial towns just before the turn of the century. Of its population of 11,000, some 3,800 were employed in the plant of the Carnegie Steel Company, America's largest and most modern steel plant at the time. The mill, fronting the curving waterfront for a mile, dominated the town. Operating around the clock, its chimneys continued belching out acrid and poisonous smoke, dust, dirt, and cinders. This was long before the subject of air pollution was even dreamed of, so that sunlight was seldom able to penetrate the ever-present dark pall. At night, the sky was lit by the blazing fires of the furnaces. The river water was contaminated by industrial waste and the sewage from upstream. Homestead was a desolate, dirty, depressing town. I remember back in the late 40s when my mother and father and I drove down to Florida looking to change locations. And we went through Birmingham. Birmingham, Alabama used to be a big steel town. And the flames went so high in the air it was lit up like you wouldn't believe. It was sort of beautiful in a way, but not beautiful in another way. I remember that very well. Conditions for the majority of the workers were deplorable. The unskilled day laborers, primarily Slavs, called dinky men or bohunks, and that's what those guys in the movie Fist were paid 14 cents an hour, $9.80 a week, the equivalent of less than $40 today. However, the earning of skilled laborers and aristocrats of the workforce were excellent, as much as $70 a week, $280 a week by today's standards. But all steel workers more than earned their wages. Working conditions were appalling. 12-hour shifts, 7-day week. Temperatures 130 degrees, no time out for meals, no washing up facilities, and no competition compensation for injuries. The year before the strike, 300 men were killed and 2,000 injured on the job in the mills around Pittsburgh alone. Only a fifth of the workers, about 700, were members of the industry union and the Amalgamated Association of Iron and Steel Workers, affiliated with the American Federation of Labor. Interesting, Samuel Gompers was the head of the American Federation of Labor. He was a Jew, but he would not tolerate any blacks in his union. Whereas the other guy, I'm trying to remember his name, head of the other union, he wanted to let the blacks in. Let's see here. Was public on record as favoring unions and approving them as a part of the ideal employer-employee relationship. Privately, he opposed them. The company's chairman and general manager, Henry Clay Frick, who was in charge of making and administering policy, was an outgoing anti-unionist, outspoken anti-unionist. He had repeatedly stated that unions should not exist. In previous clashes with organized labor, when he was Coke King prior to joining forces with Carnegie, he had crushed any worker opposition with force and made no concessions whatsoever. He brought in deputy sheriffs and state militia and private Pinkerton detectives whenever he felt they might be useful. 6 months after he joined Carnegie in 1889, Frick had settled a strike at Homestead only by making concessions. His opposition to the Amalgamated Union was therefore strengthened. The showdown came as soon as the three-year union management contract approached its expiration date on June 30, 1892. Frick suggested a reduction in tonnage rates. Wages were based on production and the current price of steel. Since prices and profits were higher than at the time of the previous contract, the union bargainers asked for a comparatively small wage increase. Frick's reply was an ultimatum. His offer remained unchanged. And furthermore, he insisted on an expiration date of January 1st rather than June 30th. Since production was lower during the winter and wages would be smaller when the next contract came up for consideration, he set a June 24th deadline for acceptance. Carnegie was conveniently absent on vacation in Scotland during both the negotiations and the subsequent strike. The union members called for a strike on July 2nd and were joined by the 3,000 non-union mechanics and common laborers. The battle lines were drawn. Frick had decided to break the union at Homestead. Even before the deadline date, he had begun signing up skilled workers from other companies, and his trump card had recruited a force of 300 armed Pinkerton detectives to protect the works and the imported scabs. These paid guards from Chicago and New York were together at Ashtabula, Ohio, on Lake Erie, a midpoint between the two cities. On the morning of July 5th, and proceed by rail to Youngstown. From there, they were to be transported at night by boat up the Monongahela River to Homestead. Since it might prove illegal to bring an armed force into the state of Pennsylvania, the rifles, pistols, billy clubs, and ammunition were to be shipped separately. The guards were to be armed after they were within the state boundaries. Frick agreed to pay $5 per day for each man. In the meantime, two barges were fitted up for the Pinkertons, one with bunks as a dormitory and the other with tables as a large dining room. Two steam tugs were engaged to tow the barges to the landing place on the Carnegie premises. When the contract deadline was not met, Frick began to shut down the works. By 30th of June, the entire workforce was locked out. To strengthen the security of the plant, a fence 15 feet high was built around it, extending to the river's edge. This was solid boards topped with barbed wire and with holes spaced along its 3-mile length, presumably for armed guards and their guns. Though Frick had asked for a force of county deputies to protect the plant, none could apparently be recruited, so the Pinkerton men were to be deputized once they had landed on the company property. By July 5th, the force of 316 Pinkertons had assembled at the designated spot below Homestead. In addition to the professionals, the motley crowd of detectives included toughs, criminals, jobless drifters, and college students on vacation. They were told only that they had been hired by a corporation as guards. They were armed with 250 Winchester rifles, 300 pistols, and ammunition. Like an army unit, they were dressed in uniforms of slouch hats and colorful bands and dark blue trousers with lighter stripes. The strikers never for a moment underestimated the tactics Frick might be employing, and so they established an elaborate system of scouts and guards to keep abreast of developments. The expedition set out shortly after midnight on July 6, 1862. The two barges at first being towed by two tugs, then after an engine failure by one, each Pinkerton man was armed and given 50 rounds of ammunition during the 4-hour trip. But such a movement could scarcely remain secret, and a Union lookout at Pittsburgh telegraphed Homestead, quote, "Watch the river, steamer, with barges left here." When the tug was approaching the spot selected for the landing inside the plant grounds, the pilot sounded the required steam whistle to indicate a landing. This was a signal for the town to come alive. Strikers joined citizens in rushing to the banks of the Monongahela River. Hundreds of armed strikers running along the shore, firing into the pitch blackness of the river. The approach to the river side of the plant, however, was blocked by the fence. In a single moment, the crowd knocked over the obstructions and rushed pell-mell to the spot where the two barges were pulled up parallel to the shoreline. At this time, the protesters were estimated to number close to 10,000 men, women, children, and boys, all bearing weapons, pistols, revolvers, rifles, clubs, sticks, or stones. At the landing, all was strangely silent. Each side appeared to be waiting for the first move to be made by the other. The leader of the Pinkerton forces shouted a warning that his men were coming ashore. He had hoped peacefully to occupy the works. When the gangplank had been laid, several strikers attempted to dislodge it without success. Jeers and stones greeted the first rifle-carrying blue-clad army enemy on the plank, but as more stepped forward, 40 had volunteered. A hail of bullets killed one and seriously wounded 5. Other Pinkertons returned the fire, and their bullets found ready marks in the dense crowd. More than 30 fell wounded, and 2 were killed instantly. The firing by both sides continued even after the guards sought shelter below deck. This first encounter had lasted only 3 minutes. During the lull, the strikers erected steel and wooden barriers at the top of the steep bank. The wounded and the dead were removed, and the non-combatants and women moved away from the line of fire to observe better the inevitable continuation of the battle. The Pinkertons' tug, meanwhile, left for Pittsburgh with the wounded under a barrage of gunfire. Daylight was approaching, and the stalemate must be broken. A representative of the strikers attempted to obtain the surrender of the hirelings, but the answer shouted to all within range was, quote, "If you don't withdraw, we will mow every one of you down," unquote. At 8 o'clock, a second landing attempt resulted in more killed and wounded on both sides. The spasmodic firing continued for more than 2 more hours, but the Pinkerton men sheltered below the decks of the barges could only fire through the limited numbers of portholes with little range. Now the strikers and their sympathizers had gained the advantage, and they sought to flush out their trapped quarry on the barges. Dynamite sticks proved effective only when thrown from nearby boats. Even then, damage was slight. Civil War cannons were then fired from both sides of the river, but they too were relatively ineffective. Then the strikers remembered the plant's oil stored in the tanks. Pumping the oil into the river upstream from the barges, they attempted to start a fire without success. Next, they ignited a raft loaded with greasy clothes and oil and cast it adrift. But the current floated and the raft safely passed the barges. Finally, a small car loaded with blazing barrels of oil was rolled down the expanse of the bank, but was deflected from its course after reaching the waterline. Sporadic gunfire continued during all these attempts at barge burning. When the tug returned from Pittsburgh and tried to approach the barges to pull them free from the shore, the fire from hundreds of armed strikers was so intense that it quickly retreated. The impasse continued. The Pinkerton forces had several times waved white surrender handkerchiefs through the portholes, only to have them shot away. For 3 afternoon hours, the Union and the strike leaders attempted to reason with the mob to convince them that further violence would inevitably lead to more casualties and that nothing could possibly be gained by the continuation of the fighting. The more determined and excited strikers resisted these appeals, but the arguments of reason finally prevailed, and at about 5 o'clock, the surrender negotiated was completed. Before disembarking, each guard was stripped of his pistol and jacket. When all 300 men were ashore, they huddled together in a frightened group while the strikers systematically pillaged the 2 barges of everything movable. The workers then set them afire, and the crowd cheered lustily as they were burned to the waterline. The Pinkerton prisoners had been promised safe passage through the plant to Homestead train station, and they started up the sloping bank to the accompanying of angry jeers, hoots, hisses, and howls. But the mob began a concentrated attack, surrounding groups and clubbing, beating, and kicking about 40 of them into unconsciousness. There was no escape in running through the gauntlet of enraged men and women and children who had been seen some of their friends and relatives wounded or killed, and almost every one of the mercenaries was injured. After being held under close guard in the town theater, the Pinkerton men finally entrained at midnight for Pittsburgh. The casualties of this shocking, sickening, uncivilized day were never accurately totaled. The most unreliable figure was that at least 35 strikers and Pinkertons dead and 400 injured, many of them seriously. Frick's appeal to Governor Patterson for aid was not answered until July 12, when 8,000 Pennsylvania National Guardsmen marched in quietly to take over control of the homestead under martial law. The strikers were forced off the company's premises. With such protection, Frick began bringing in scabs and proceeding to file charges against the strike leaders for attack on the Pinkertons. Public sympathy was overwhelmingly in favor of the strikers, and the juries in the first 3 murder trials voted an acquittal. No more were brought into trial. An additional 167 strikers were indicted, but the charges were eventually dropped. The troops remained until mid-October, at which time 2,000 non-union strike breakers were well on the road to reestablishing full production. By November, the amalgamated treasury was empty and the strike was abandoned. The union members did not get their jobs back. The union was broken, and not until 1935, with the formation of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, did the nation's steelworkers effectively organize again. Henry C. Frick sworn enemy of unionism had carried out his threat. Furthermore, only some 800 of the original non-union working force was reinstated, for Frick was not one to forgive and forget. An anarchist from New York, Alexander Berkman, inflamed by the newspaper accounts of the strike, forced his way into Frick's office in Pittsburgh and attempted to assassinate him. Although shot and stabbed, the autocratic magnate survived. After the strike, he and the Carnegie became bitter enemies. The Homestead strike was not a spontaneous uprising on the part of unorganized workers. It was a war between one of the most powerful of the great modern corporations. The expanding Carnegie Steel Company became the United States Steel Corporation. Incidentally, that's where J. Edgar Hoover came out. He originally, as a young man, was working in security for one of these big steel companies. And then he got brought into the federal government. A lot of people don't know that. The company won and the riotous strikers lost in what was one of the more tragic chapters in the history of United States labor management relations. Homestead and the Pullman Chapter 9 are but two of the major strikes in American labor history which have included full-scale riots. Among others were the National Railroad Strike of 1877, the Chicago McCormick Reaper Strike in 1886, which triggered the Haymarket Riot with the first bombing in American labor history, that of the Pennsylvania anthracite coal miners in 1902. The National Steel Strike of 1919, the Coal Miners National Strike in 1922, and the West Coast Longshoremen's Walkout in 1934. Excuse my pooches. All have shown the determination of the unions to achieve the best possible conditions of and the rewards for work. The rioters and industrial strikes have possessed an unequaled desperation, and the gains of the laboring man, painfully achieved step by step, form a record of frustrations and failures as well as success. And that's just one of the big strikes. People keep telling you what a wonderful country, how there were never hardly any problems and only black people had problems, are bullshitting you. It was a struggle from the word go, and they had secret labor societies like the Molly Maguires. There's a good movie about that. And then Manitowoc, another movie that you should see about the big coal mine strikes down in Virginia and down south. I mean, they really went at it. But they don't talk about that in your school. Your kids don't hear about that. Mostly white men, some blacks, but mostly white. It's a hell of a history. And it's not over, because whatever happened before will ultimately in some way happen again. There is a real depression coming, and if the big bubble bursts and things go to hell, I mean, you're going to see these are going to be nothing compared to what it could be. Cover the great Pullman strike in Chicago tomorrow. I've been there to that town that Pullman built. He was the guy who put all the Pullman train cars together. But that was a vicious strike too. One thing's terrible about that town, they built some fabulous homes there of the rich, but now they did degenerate it into housing for niggers. And you know what niggers do. Luckily, they're all built out of stone and concrete, so they can destroy the things that'll burn, be carried off, but they can't destroy the building. So hopefully someday, and maybe that's happening, all those beautiful old buildings can be reclaimed by responsible white people.
Bloody Railroad Wars by John Jewell, Part 1. Imperialism has now reached a degree of almost scientific perfection. It uses white workers to conquer the non-white workers of the colonies. Then, it hurls the non-white workers of one colony against those of another non-white colony. Finally, it relies on the colored workers of the colonies to rule the white workers. Recently, white French soldiers near Mutiny in the occupied Ruhr of Germany were surrounded by French African soldiers, and colored native light infantry were sent against white German strikers, Ho Chi Minh, 1923. An economic panic seized America in 1873, caused by banking, stock, and railroad speculation. It followed only 3 years after Black Friday on Wall Street, when the sordid corruption and bribery of the government by financiers Gould and Risk caused a similar crash. The bankruptcy in 1873 of J. Cook & Co., after a failed railroad takeover scheme, triggered a great panic on Broad Street and the New York Stock Exchange, leading from Wall Street to the banks and a nationwide credit crunch. This financial slump spawned a major depression, lasting from 1873 through 1877. 23,000 businesses folded. 3 million workers were unemployed, out of a total of 40 million. Unemployment benefits and welfare relief was non-existent. Real wages were cut by almost 50%. In 1877, the railroad magnates, including sinister Jay Gould, who had scuttled from stock fraud and government bribery into a transcontinental railroad empire, announced yet another 10% wage cut for railway workers. Gould, backed by his gunmen of the Pinkerton detectives, could brag, "I can hire one half of the working class to kill the other half." Gould spoke from past experience. He, and every other principal capitalist involved in the corruption of the 1870s, had been created by the sellout of the U.S. government to high finance in the mass murder of the American Civil War. The uprising begins on July 16, 1877, in Camden, Maryland. 40 brakemen and firemen refused to work at a station of the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. The next day, in Martinsburg, West Virginia, 800 strikers halted trains. Mayor and police arrested strike leaders. Joining railmen were miners, the unemployed and local farmhand. A mob of 1,200 attacked the town jail and freed the strike leaders. Two companies of state militia, 80 men, entered Martinsburg. One guardsman was wounded and a striking fireman killed in the ensuing melee. The overwhelmed militia surrendered some of the guardsmen and officers going over to the strikers. On the appeal of the state governor, U.S. President Hayes, who had been defeated in the 1876 election but inaugurated after a political deal with Southern politicians, dispatched five companies of U.S. artillery to quell the West Virginia disturbances. In support of the strikers, railway men in Pittsburgh stopped all freight traffic to the area on the Pennsylvania Railroad at Cumberland, Maryland. The state militia dispersed strikers, killing one. The strike then spread throughout Maryland, Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, Illinois, and Missouri. It would eventually reach the Pacific, with 100,000 strikers in armed revolt in 17 states and territories. Thousands were killed and wounded and injured. Major battles occurred, even seeing the use of cannons and Gatling machine guns. Property damage, especially of burned rail yards and stock, was staggering. Whole cities were in the hands of strikers for several days. In some cities, strike committees ran essential services. From the Atlantic to Pacific, police and militias were defeated. The insurrection was crushed by federal troops, including artillery, naval warships, marines, and cavalry forces pulled in from Indian fighting. Most of the events were a spontaneous upsurge of unorganized white workers. But in Chicago, St. Louis, and San Francisco, the Radical Workmen's Party, WMP, led the revolt politically. In Chicago, anarchists dominated, in St. Louis, the Marxian communists, in the West, spreading through Denver and Salt Lake City to San Francisco, the rebellion became an anti-Chinese uprising of white racist workers. The Workmen's Party of California was organized and led by radical white racists. Bloody class war in Baltimore, Maryland, a mob of 6,000 built barricades to block city streets on the arrival of state militia. With women to the front, the strikers attempted to halt three companies, 120 men, of the 6th MD Regiment as they marched from an armory to clear the main train station. When guardsmen attacked the women, stones began to fly. The militia opened fire, more stones and gunshots came in reply. 12 rioters were killed and 18 wounded. 20 guardsmen were seriously injured. In a firefight at the train depot, police killed 7 rioters. A scab, non-union worker, brakeman was attacked and wounded by strikers. The 5th MD Regiment, 150 men, was stoned en route from their armory. 8 guardsmen, including a captain, lieutenant, sergeant, and corporal were severely injured. Rioters were dispersed by a bloody bayonet charge. A mob then destroyed the train dispatch house with incendiaries. The next day, 3 companies of U.S. Engineer Corp. were stoned by a mob of 500. A contingent of 100 Marines landed in the port. Police swore in 3,000 special constables. The following day, rioters fired a train of 37 oil cars. Troops and police dispersed the mob. 8 rioters were killed and 17 wounded, 8 policemen were wounded. The retreating strikers fired a lumberyard and planing mill. Meanwhile, U.S. President Hayes had surrounded nearby Washington, D.C. with troops. In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, railway workers locked their engines in the main depot roundhouses. Local militiamen refused to fire on the strikers. Miners, other traders, the unemployed, and deserters from the local militia joined the railway men. 600 men of the upper-crust Philadelphia militia invaded and seized the main roundhouse, killing 26 workers and wounding 20, many old men, boys, and children. Strikers counterattacked, 5,000 strong, trapping the troops all night inside the roundhouse. The Philadelphia forces used mobile cannons and Gatling machine guns. The workers had raided an armory, a gun factory, and a gun shop. Fierce fighting ensued the next day, 91 persons were killed and 209 were wounded. The militiamen fought their way out of the roundhouse, abandoning cannon and Gatlings, and retreated to the countryside. Rioters looted and fired locomotives, boxcars, roundhouses, shops, the Union Depot, grain elevators, and every railroad dock and building. Liberty Street was a wall of flames for 3 miles. Destroyed were 1,600 boxcars and 126 locomotives. Final costs topped $5 million, an incredible sum in 1,877. The governor declared Pennsylvania in a state of domestic insurrection and wired U.S. President Hayes that local militia were unreliable. The country, he warned, would soon be in a state of anarchy and revolution. President Hayes sent in massive federal forces to occupy Pittsburgh. Tenement houses were searched, block by block, and entire families arrested on suspicion of looting or possession of dangerous weapons. In Reading, Pennsylvania, a mob of 3,000 strikers stoned 253 militiamen. 200 guardsmen were injured. A firefight ensued, 12 strikers were killed, 50 were wounded, 6 mortally. 20 militia and 5 police were wounded. That night, strikers burned down a new bridge, costing $150,000. In Philadelphia, home of reaction, rioters fired 9 oil tanks and boxcars of oil barrels. Police dispersed them and then fired into a meeting of the Workingmen's Party, killing one. In Chimokan, Pot, strikers tore up track and plundered rail cars. Militia killed 4 and wounded 5. Rioting also occurred at Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Smash the State in Buffalo, New York, a fight at the Lakeshore Roundhouse resulted in 3 strikers killed and 2 militia officers and 6 police knifed and bludgeoned. A company of militia went over to the strikers. The NY Central Railroad was blockaded. The state militia commander, General Carr, vowed to crush the strike at all costs. New militia forces attacked, wounding several strikers at a riot in the stockyards. A militiaman was also wounded. On the 22nd of July, the Workingmen's Party rallied 4,000 workers in Cincinnati, Ohio. The next day, railway men struck. After an attack by police, a mob burned the bridge over the Ohio River. The rail strike spread to all trades in F.T. Wayne, Indiana, including women hotel workers. Strikers controlled the city for several days. 2 gangs of tramps and a band of drunken looters descending from Columbia City were routed. All industries struck in Indianapolis, Indiana, and in Louisville, Kentucky. In New York City, red flags decorated the Bowery slums and a mob of 300 stoned police. They were dispersed by a bloody baton charge, several rioters and police were injured. Coal miners in the East then struck. 45,000 anthracite miners went out in Pennsylvania. Rebel sentiment was especially strong in the anthracite mines of Pennsylvania State. From 1860 to 1875, the Molly Maguires, an underground secret society of Irish immigrant miners, the Ancient Order of Hibernians, led murderous attacks on mine officials, strikebreakers, and traders. Infiltrated by the detestable Pinkerton detectives, the Molly leaders were hanged between 1877 and 1879. The bituminous coal fields of Maryland, West Virginia, and Illinois were shut down. Wages had been cut from $4 to $2.50 a week. Now, any man who by working 12 hours earned $1 was docked 10% to lower costs to the mine owners. 500 miners in Scranton, Pennsylvania attacked with pick handles and pistols the shops of Delaware, Lackawanna, and Western Railroads, wrecking the premises and beating scab workers. The city mayor had his jaw broken. The mob grew to 5,000. 28 vigilantes armed with Remington repeating rifles, killed 3 strikers and wounded 25, several fatally. The strikers returned fire with a few pistols, wounding 2 vigilantes. 2,000 troops arrived to occupy the city. The strike now spread westward, generating general strikes in Chicago, St. Louis, Kansas City, and Galveston, Texas. The Workingmen's Party in Chicago and St. Louis, the new Workingmen's Party politically led the strikes. Anarchists dominated the Chicago section, and Marxist communists in St. Louis. Organized in 1876, the Workingmen's Party was an outgrowth of the International Workingmen's Association, or First International, which collapsed after infighting between followers of the totalitarian communist German Jew Karl Marx and the libertarians led by Russian anarchist Mikhail Bakunin. Marx had transferred headquarters from London to New York City just before the collapse. Anarchists in America organized the Black International in Pittsburgh, the International Working People's Association. A socialist labor party was formed in 1878, and libertarians formed a rival split from the Marxists, known as the Revolutionary Socialist Labor Party. A strike was declared in Chicago after a further wage cut on the railways. July 23, 1877, Monday 40 switchmen on the Michigan Central RR struck. Tuesday, July 24, all freight was stopped. A mass march through the city closed stockyards, packing houses, factories, and brought out the crews of lake boats on Lake Michigan. Meanwhile, police had formed a special constabulary, which included Civil War veterans of the Grand Army of the Republic. 10,000 strikers and supporters gathered for WMP speeches. Constituting the crowd the Grand Army of Starvation, a speaker from the WMP declared, "Better 1,000 of us to be shot down in the streets than 10,000 of us die starving." Speeches were given in both German for immigrant workers and English for native white workers. The press called them the Committee of the Communes, comparing the strikers to the bloody Paris Commune uprising of 1871. Synopsis: a major economic depression struck the U.S. in 1873, triggered by a failed railroad takeover scheme and a panic on Wall Street and in the major banking houses. After 3 years of misery for white working people, the railroad capitalists made massive wage cuts on railway workers. Strikes and bloody riots spread through Maryland, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, Indiana, and Kentucky. Large-scale fighting saw hundreds of white men, women, and children murdered by state troops and the regular armed forces. On the 23rd and 24th of July, 1877, fighting broke out in Chicago. Looting gun shops were plundered of 150 revolvers, 50 rifles, and a gross of brass knuckles. Strikers seized railway yards and derailed a passing train. Wednesday, July 25, all trades went out, including tanneries, stoneworks, brickyards, furniture factories, lumberyards, livery stables, distilleries. After police viciously clubbed a band of youths in a freight yard, an enraged mob of 20,000 attacked police. Three rioters were killed and nine wounded, the total was actually higher, but many riot casualties were carted away privately. Four police were wounded, one fatally. Strikers seized the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad roundhouse, extinguishing all engine fires. Police arrived, killing five. That night, a mass working man's party, WMP, rally held at Market and Madison Streets, was attacked by police. Thursday, July 26, the Illinois 2nd Regiment entered Chicago. 50 separate mobs battled police and militia. In a running fight at the Halsted Street Viaduct and railroad tracks below, six police were shot, 18 rioters were killed and 32 wounded, and the city viaduct destroyed. Police raided a meeting of cabinet makers discussing the 8-hour day, killing one and beating the others. A riot of Bohemian, Czech, women stoned police, a 14-year-old girl was shot. Rioters swelled to 25,000. U.S. regulars and cavalry were pulled in from fighting Sioux and Cheyenne Indians. The city of Chicago was retaken for the master class, with a total of 30 killed and 100 wounded. One policeman died of wounds. Among those killed was a leader of the Workingmen's Party, Frank Norbeck. Another WMP leader, Nicholas Schilling, was wounded. Part 2, Marxists in St. Louis, Indiana. St. Louis, a general strike was erratically led by an executive committee formed by a coalition of minor trade union officials and the Workingmen's Party. The WMP was dominated by Marxist communists, mostly German immigrants from the failed 1848-1849 revolution in Germany and active in St. Louis since the start of the U.S. Civil War. The German Marxists had included several high-ranking Union generals, radical and liberal Republican politicians, and occupation agents during the crushing of the popular Southern insurgency in rural Missouri. Several of the WMP leaders were former members of the International Workingmen's Association, and one in St. Louis, James Cope, had aided Karl Marx at the inauguration of the IWA in London, 1864. Monday, July 20.
That's from the works of John Jewell, our great comrade who used to be with the IWW up in Canada till his racial views got him kicked out. I'm not sure whatever happened to John, but they come and they go, you know. So that's about half of that story. I'll play the other half tomorrow. Now, some of you probably have heard this, but I think it's good for you to hear it again and again, because I think this is what you're going to see coming at some point in this country, and it's going to be a lot different. It's not going to be just whites rising up. It's going to be the blacks, and going to be the Mexicans, and going to be who else? Who knows? It's going to be y'all come, free for all. So, maybe not, but I think it will. I know human nature pretty well. I'll see you tomorrow on Tears Day. Meanwhile, keep your powder dry. Stay out of the streets. Don't let some right-wing yahoo talk you into joining some organization that's going to get your ass capped.